How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
Welcome to Sustainable Futures. It's just me this week. Kimberly Tay is still on a bit of a really busy time, but I'm here, and I've got a couple of interviews for you this week. We've got a bit of a theme going on. One aspect of sustainable futures that I'd like to bring in more is the aspect of sustainable mind, sustainable concepts, the concept of how to be a sustainable person. It goes deeper than just the outward. It's a state of being, and I'm very happy to have the first segment of a two-part interview with Bob Cole. And Bob Cole is a fellow who moved to an island off the coast, the west coast of Chile, right on the Pacific Ocean, to live there for a year, just by himself, alone on an island. And in this segment, he'll be talking about sort of the planning that went into the trip, what sorts of things he brought, why he did it, and what kinds of things, and how he survived day to day. And then in the next week's episode, he's going to talk more about the mental aspects of things and how to survive on your own on an island, and also some bigger projects that sort of come afterward, and more about the book that he's written. He's written a book about his sustainable adventure, which will be part of my introduction. Also on the show will be an interview with Conrad Schmidt of the Work Less Party. And the Work Less Party is all around the idea of working less, which creates more time for arts and culture and things that are great for our spirit and soul, which arguably makes for a much more sustainable life. And he's going to make a sort of economic argument in this interview. He'll be talking about Jevons' paradox and also about the Work Less Party in general. So very happy to have that interview too. So we have two interviews, one with Bob Cole, which is the first of two segments, and an interview with Conrad Schmidt. This is Ryan Fletcher of Sustainable Futures with Bob Cole, who has released a book recently called Solitude, Seeking Wisdom in Extremes, A Year Alone in the Patagonia Wilderness. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me. It's good to be here.
Okay, and congratulations on the book and surviving a year.
Yeah, surviving is important. That's a good thing. And thank you for congratulations on the book. It's wonderful. Just a fantastic publisher, New World Library down in the States, and it's just been great. So working with them has been a really fun and important part of the whole process.
So let's get right down to it. Why do you like solitude?
It's in some ways beyond liking. I feel a call to it. I feel strongly pulled to it. And if I don't follow that call, I start getting off center and my life becomes kind of shallow and narrow. And it's not that I spend all my time in solitude. I also value human relationships profoundly. And time in solitude, from my experience, actually deepens my relationships with others. In solitude, I come into a deeper relationship with myself, which then opens possibilities for relationship with others. So it calls me in that way. I also really like the simplicity of life solitude. The psychological aspect is not always simple at all, but usually the physicality is, life comes down to its bare essentials. Mm-hmm. And I like that very much. There's a sense of sustainability about it, that I'm not generating a lot of waste. I'm very aware of what I'm eating, because I always eat less when I'm in solitude, because whatever I eat, I either have to fish for or take with me.
All the work that goes into it.
Yeah, and because everything I have, I've had to take with me, I never just toss anything out. Everything gets reused over and over as long as it possibly can. And the other thing, an important part of, for me, environmentalism is recycling, but not only like tin cans, but to use old things. So the fishing gear I use, I've had since I was a 12-year-old kid, some of it.
Oh, wow. Good for you.
And I really enjoy that, repairing things and fixing them up and then using stuff that was once for one purpose, using it for another purpose now as raw materials. And that whole sense of recycling in that way, of continuing to use things and repair things and keep them going, gives me great joy, that tinkering aspect of things.
So where did you go?
I went to a tiny island. It's about 150 meters by 250 meters, too small to even be on the maps. And it's way down almost to the tip of South America, way down in Patagonia on the Chilean coast. The Chilean coast is similar to the British Columbia, Alaskan coast in that it's fractured. And there's mountains that crash right into the sea, and there's glaciers. It's even more fractured than the British Columbia coast. And so there's no road that goes down the Chilean side of the Andes. And the Andes just soar up from the sea. It's spectacularly beautiful down there. And there's nobody down there. Chile is not like Canada. There's not crown land in the same way that Canada has. So everything is either privately owned or protected. And the whole western side of South America, the Chilean side, almost all of it is protected one way or the other in huge reserves or national parks. And there's just nobody in there. It's not national parks like we would think of them that have been developed. They're simply areas set aside where there's nobody in there. So there were no airplanes. I saw people once during the year. There's no boats. There's no kayakers. There's no mining. There's no logging. So I wanted to be down there. I consider the coast of BC, but it's just crowded. Not compared to Vancouver, but relatively.
Yeah, relatively.
Yeah, and I was up the coast of BC just in June and July for 7 weeks, and there wasn't a day that I didn't hear and see airplanes and helicopters and other boats and stuff. So it's just really remote down there. And I was 125, 130. 30 or 40 kilometers by sea from the nearest small town. As a crow flies, it was closer, but I couldn't get there because it was over the other side of the Andes. So it was really remote.
Wow. So just out of curiosity, how do the Andes compare to the Rockies? Are they larger mountains, or what are the kind of mountains are they?
Yeah, they are larger. They're huge mountains. They're not as high as the Himalayas, but they're higher than the Rockies. I think they're higher than anything on the coast of BC. I can't remember the highest peaks in the Andes. And they're not as high down, far down south as they are up into the main part of South America. They're in Peru, they're very high. Yeah. But they're spectacular. They're jagged, rugged, lots of glaciers. The huge southern ice field is down there, and it's got fingers that pour down into individual valleys as individual glaciers on both sides, both into Argentina and to Chile.
Okay. And the island you're on, was that a mountainous island? Or
no, it was very flat. Probably, it was just tiny. So, like I said, it was only 150 meters by...
It'd be pretty tough to have a mountain in that much space.
It was very densely wooded.
Yeah,
I only crossed it once, and it took an hour and a half to go the 150 meters. It was rugged inside the island with lots of gullies and rock piles and stuff like that. And then so almost like a pickup sticks look of fallen trees and then other trees growing off of these trees and brush in there. And so during this walk across, I crawled a lot of it, and I never took a step without holding on because I think I was kind of on the ground, and I'd, you know, kind of peer down through the brush, and I'd be up in the air two or three meters sometimes. And so it was intense. And then as soon as you leave sea level, so there was other islands right close around that did soar up. The rocks soared up. And as soon as you leave sea level, maybe 100 feet above sea level, it just turns to bare rock. And the ecosystem changes completely at that point.
Hmm. What sorts of trees were they? Really tall trees like here? Or
no. The trees down there are very different. There's a lot of the southern beach. I don't really know trees all that well. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, for some strange reason, take a field guide for trees or birds or anything with me. So I got to know the trees because I lived with them.
Yes.
But I didn't and still don't really know the official names of them. And I looked some up, and some are in my book, but I never remember them after. There were cypress trees, which were wonderful for kindling. Mm-hmm. They were semi-straight, but not hugely tall. There were a few places in the surrounding areas when I'd be out exploring in my boat. I saw a few places with fairly tall trees, but mostly they're very tangled and curved and brittle trees. It's not like the softwood here where you get soaring timber. Some of the trees changed colors in the winter. The beech trees change color, and they're very different from up here where the leaves are large that turn color up. Up here, down there, they're small leaves, and so it looked kind of like a pointless painting, impressionist painting. Mm-hmm. Very few mammals, land mammals. There are on the mainland pumas, cougars, Guanaco, which are a llama, kind of a llama, and a few small rodents. On the tiny island I was on, there were a few rodents that I didn't know were there until my cat brought in a few. There's, an ostrich-like creature on the mainland, and a waimul, which is a sort of a deer in the deer family. Mm-hmm. Then in the sea, there were dolphins and sea lions and otters, mm-hmm. And lots of different kinds of birds. That was the wonder, is many, many, many different kinds of birds, some local and some migratory. And my closest neighbors were a pair of flightless steamer ducks. Mm-hmm. Totally fascinating birds, absolutely fascinating, endlessly creative, and I just spent a long, long time just being with them, watching them. They mate for a long time, perhaps for life, and they defend a territory. Mm-hmm. And there was another pair just across the basin from them, and so I got to watch their territorial defense stuff and how all that played out during the year. That was a wonderful part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's caracara, which is kind of an eagle, and there's hawks, and there's woodpeckers, and kingfisher, condors, which condors are spectacular.
They're really large, right?
Yeah, they are, and they're mythical for me. You know, mm-hmm. I see condors, and I just went, whoa. And various kinds of seagulls and cormorants and other kelp geese, and just lots a variety of birds, a gestalt of birds at times.
Mm-hmm. And how did you arrive? How did you get there?
I shipped 2 crates of stuff from here in Vancouver by sea. The logistics were challenging. So I had 2 crates. Each of them was a little over a cubic meter, probably a cubic meter and a half. And I shipped those to Punta Arenas, which is a fairly good-sized city. I think it's 100,000+, right on the Straits of Magellan, the tip of South America, before you cross over to Tierra del Fuego.
Mm-hmm.
And then I flew to Santiago de Chile
mm-hmm.
and spent a week there visiting friends. And from there, I bussed down through Argentina, because, as I said, there's no road down the Chilean side, so mm-hmm. I crossed over the Andes down through Argentina. You catching a Chilean bus that'll take you all the way down, but it goes through Argentina
mm-hmm.
to Punta Arenas. And then I set up shop in Punta Arenas for, I guess I was there 6 weeks or so, continuing to buy supplies, all the heavy stuff, the food and lumber and all that kind of stuff I mm-hmm. bought there in Punta Arenas. And then once I had it all bought and stored in the backyard in the room I was renting, I hired a truck.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the challenge of all this, I was doing it on as tight a budget as I could do. I wasn't getting big funding for it. And so a lot of the gear I have had for years, just because I use for camping and fishing and everything else I could buy secondhand, I did. So everything I bought, it was always looking for the most economical way to do this. So I trucked the stuff from Punta Arenas north a couple of hundred kilometers to Puerto Natales, and that's a small town that's known as the stepping-off point for Torres de Paine National Park, which is a very famous trekking park down there.
Okay, yeah.
And then from there, I was looking for a way to get up island further, because I had picked out a spot. I wanted to be, like I said, about 150 kilometers from the nearest small town, and so I picked out some potential spots up here on the maps. I'm talking to government officials down there. They said,
So you hadn't had it narrowed down to that island at that point?
No. Okay. We narrowed it down to a bay that was 20 kilometers from that island.
Uh-huh.
It was protected, and the guy said nobody ever goes in there. Some of the other spots I had pointed out on the map to him, he said, you might see fishermen out here. If you really don't want to see anybody for the year, go down to this bay. You're close to the mountains, and the fishing's not that great in there as far as commercial fishing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I checked around how much people charged to take me in. It was too expensive. And the Navy, somebody said, talk to the Navy. And they finally agreed that they would take me in, but they wouldn't take me to the bay because it's so unknown that they had no depth soundings on their charts.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we'll drop you on this beach 20 kilometers from there, and you can figure out how to get down there in your inflatable boat. So they took me in, and we started to unload on this beach, and then a storm, one of many, many storms, rolled in, and the captain said, it's too dangerous. And so we went into the lee of a larger island, and in the lee of that larger island was this small island. And there was a tiny cove there, and that's where we unloaded the rest of the stuff. And I waited there for 10 days each day, hoping for decent weather to start taking my stuff to the bay. It was going to take me like a week to get it down there.
Yeah.
And the weather just was windy. Just it's one of the windiest places on Earth down there. It's just incredibly.
I was about to ask you that, because I know that that area is one of the windiest places on
Earth.
It
is. Yeah. It's probably, I think it's the only landmass foolish enough to hang down that far into the southern hemisphere. So the wind whistles right around the globe and hit that western coast.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And it's just, it's amazing. It's unpredictable as far as I could tell. I had a barometer, and I couldn't find any correlation between the barometer and what the weather was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And in one day, the weather, a huge storm will roll through and just batter you, and then it's gone, and then it clears up, and it's kind of calm, and then another huge storm rolls through and batters you, and it can hail and blow and rain and snow all in the same day in a matter of hours.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
When it does, the ocean gets rough in a hurry. So
yeah.
Eventually, I just gave it up and stayed on this little island where, by serendipity, the Navy had dropped me.
Uh-huh.
And there was no stream for water, but it rained so much. And my plan was always to catch water off the cabin roof that I was going to build. I had a 55-gallon drum to store
water. You are listening to Sustainable Futures. This is an interview with Bob Cull. So you built a cabin, yeah.
I did.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. I built the water table is, I don't know, 7, 8, 10 inches centimeters under the surface.
Uh-huh.
And so as soon as you disturb it, it turns into a mud hole. So I dug down to bedrock about 18 inches and put in pilings. And I used some trees. I cut off a few small trees to use as pilings as well, left them rooted. And then I put stringers in and built my floor up on that about a foot and a half, 2 feet off the earth. And I could hide firewood under there and stuff. And so I built a floor and then a frame of 2x4s and 2x2s and one single slant roof with plywood, and then covered it with tarp. And I covered the whole outside with tarp, translucent tarp, so I'd have plenty of light coming in so I wouldn't have to be burning a lot of electric light. And I also set in plexiglass windows so I could see out.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the inside of the 2x4s, 2x2s, I stretched clear plastic. So that created a 2-inch dead air space for insulation. And I heated it with firewood. I took a stove down, and gathering firewood was an ongoing task for me during the year. And it was interesting because one of the challenges in the logistics is, you know, if you just imagine everything you're going to need for the next year of your life, mm-hmm. all the food, all the repair kits, any medical stuff, you know, keep the outboards running, keep the chainsaw running, everything. And you're not going to be where you live now. You have to go someplace and create an environment for yourself, heading into the wilderness, and you can't come out for supplies. That's it. Whatever you didn't take, you didn't take.
Yeah.
And so I made lists for a couple of years before I went. And, I did quite well, but there were a few things that didn't work out so well. One was my plan was to staple the tarp on the outside of the framework and staple the plastic on the inside. And I took a staple gun and 2,000 staples for the job. And I got there and discovered that none of the staples were the right size for the gun. It was unbelievable.
Oh, no.
I was very careful about the...
A little thing like that will drive you crazy,
probably. Oh, and it almost did.
Yeah.
I had to take apart 2,000 staples by hand with side cutters and drive them in with a hammer.
Oh, my.
And it just, you know, I was constantly smashing my fingers. It was a very slow process, and it really allowed me to develop patience. It was also an opportunity to kind of stretch the creative limits of my profanity.
Profanity?
Oh, I mean, yes. You know, there'd be a peaceful afternoon, and all of a sudden, there's just foul language rolling down the waterways and bouncing off the rock cliffs. You know, smack my finger yet again with the hammer. It was pretty interesting. I kind of wondered at times what the animals were thinking. You know, what's that?
That's interesting, profanity, because I know that's something I use the opportunity of being alone to do if I'm in a bad mood.
Oh, yeah.
Is that something you do often?
Much less than I used to.
Yeah.
And I also enjoy swearing around people. And to me, it depends how profanity is used. I love language. The language to me is just a joy. Mm-hmm. And so profanity for me is like seasoning in cooking.
Yeah.
You know, it adds spice to language. And if you just do it all the time, if everything's fucking this and fucking that, then it's just like over-salting stuff or over-seasoning something.
Yeah.
But if you're shocked by it and you never use it and it's as though something's horrible with it, to me, that's a confusion in people's thinking. They're just words. They're useful words. And so at times in my book, has profanity in it, clearly. And the journal, the original journal, had way more.
Yeah.
Because that's what was going on. You know, that's how I was expressing myself mm-hmm. to myself in the journal. And I was a logger for years, and so you know, that was part of my... And I've worked a lot of construction work, and it's just part
that's
of...
That's a culture of it.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So it's kind of an interesting barometer for my inner state of mind. When I catch myself using a lot of profanity, mm-hmm. it's a sign that I'm kind of out of balance with myself.
Mm-hmm.
And if I catch myself not using any profanity, it's as though I'm trying to be too spiritual or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I understand you brought a cat with you, and what are some other things that you brought? You brought a stove?
Yeah, I took a propane stove.
Yeah.
And I didn't take all this stuff from Canada by any means. I knew that I was going to need a wood-burning stove, so I took an airtight from up here. I didn't take stovepipe because shipping stuff down is expensive. So
yes.
The only things I took from up here were things that I thought I might have difficulty finding down there.
Mm-hmm.
So I took all my electronics from up here. Because my agreement with the university is that I would take a satellite telephone and once a month I would check in with them to let them know I was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also kind of a safety net. And off in the past when I've gone off into solitude for 2 or 3 months at a time, nobody's known where I was. And
mm-hmm.
But this time I'm a little older and not wiser necessarily, but a little more cautious and aware of vulnerabilities.
Uh-huh.
And so I was glad to have the sat phone with me. And I took an outboard motor and about 150 gallons of gas and took a chainsaw. And because I had the satellite phone, then I needed a source of electricity. So I took a wind generator and a couple solar panels.
Cool.
Just kind of one thing led to the next. So this was a real high technology from my perspective. Now, from somebody else's perspective, it wasn't high technology at all. But from my perspective, this is very high technology stuff that mm-hmm. I was doing here. And it caused me lots of headaches because I had difficulty with the technology a lot early on, especially. And so it just kept me tangled up on that level of troubleshooting stuff, which can be kind of fun sometimes, but it can also be very frustrating. Mm-hmm. And so I got the chimney made down there, and the sheet metal wasn't very good. And so within a few months, my chimney started to rot out, which was just another one of the frustrations. And, you know, I'm all set up. I've got plenty of firewood, and I'm still going to be sitting in a cold, dark cabin because my chimney's rotted out. Mm-hmm. And but I managed to repair it. And then one day I was sitting there. There's lots of time to just kind of think about things. And
yeah.
It occurred to me, I thought, oh, you know what? I bought those 7 cans of powdered milk with me. And I wonder if those cans are about the same size as the chimney. So I measured them, and they were exactly the same diameter. So I opened them up and put all the milk in Ziploc bags, and I cut the ends out of the cans and spliced them in as chimney lengths in the rotted sections. And so they lasted fine for the rest of the year. So
cool.
I used duct tape and wire. Well, real important generic materials are wire of many gauges.
Uh-huh.
You got to take wire. And I ran out of nails eventually, and I just cut new nails from lengths of wire, heavy wire.
Uh-huh.
And shoe goo is, or marine goo, that's, you know, a hugely useful. And duct tape. Duct tape is vital. If I'm pretty sure if Napoleon had duct tape, we'd be speaking French in the whole world. with duct tape, you can kind of do anything. You know, duct tape's really huge.
Uh-huh. Now, what's the shoe goo?
Shoe goop is it's kind of a silicone stuff,
uh-huh.
And it comes in a tube, and it's just fantastic. It's useful for so many things. So I got a prosthetic leg, which makes walking harder,
mm-hmm.
And because of that, I really look for the lightest weight boots I can find, because heavy boots it's an enormous weight at the end of this lever, and so I wear cheap, inexpensive, regular hiking boots, very comfortable. They last about a year. They're not, mm-hmm. you know. And I bought rubber boots down there, and I didn't expect to be living in the rubber boots as much as I was. I barely ever went outside without them because it was so wet every place.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so fairly early on, they started cracking, and I went, uh-oh. And I would just smear shoe goo on them. And
yeah.
After a while, it was almost like the boot had become a mold. And the whole outside of one of them especially was covered in shoe goo, you know, and I just put another coat of it on. And so by the time I was done...
So it's a coating type thing that...
Yeah, well, yeah, it's very similar to silicone. It's a kind of... I think it actually is a kind of silicone.
Uh-huh.
But it comes in tubes rather than a gun.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's very useful.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, and you can... What it's used for, you can actually build... And it's tough. You can build up the heel of a shoe with it. You know, if your shoe heel is run down or something like that, or if your sole has come loose from a shoe, that's why it was originally called shoe goo. You glue the sole back on. It's completely
mm-hmm.
waterproof, and it remains flexible.
Mm-hmm.
Sticks to almost anything.
Mm-hmm. So,
cat, you were asked about the cat.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to take a cat. One of the joys for me of solitude is to not have the responsibility of another being that
mm-hmm.
I have to link my own behaviors to, that I can just follow my inner rhythms and
yeah.
and the rhythms of the non-human world. And in taking a pet, it just changes all that, changes the whole mood, it, you know, sometimes more than others. So it wasn't my intention. But there's a lot of red tide in southern Chile. And the commercial fisheries depend on government reports to tell them areas where there's red tide, they don't fish there. But I wasn't going to be where I had access to the government reports. And so the officials there said, you know, if you're planning to eat any of the marine life, any shellfish at all, oysters or mussels or clams or anything like that, any bivalve filter feeder, you need to take a cat with you, because that's what the locals do. They use the cats as guinea pigs.
Oh, no.
Yes. They feed shellfish to the cat, and if the cat dies, they don't eat it. And I went, okay. And so in their backyard of the parks office, they had a female cat had given birth to a litter. And they wanted me to take a couple of them, and so they captured a couple. And these kittens had never been touched. They were wild. And so I went down my last night before leaving town and to put them in a box. And the female of the two, there was a male and a female, and that kind of put me off a bit. I thought after a year we could have a whole herd of kittens.
Yeah, yes.
And The male was a little more mellow, but the female just bit and clawed and scratched me, and I thought, you know, she really doesn't want to go, and so I just took the male.
Yeah.
It turned out to be a very interesting and challenging part of the year, my relationship with this cat.
Uh-huh.
And it showed me a lot of parts of myself that I wasn't very happy with, because he would just trigger rage in me. He'd get right in the middle of whatever I was doing, and he'd cry and cry and cry, and I couldn't get him to shut up. Or I'd had spent an hour sneaking up on birds to take their picture, and he'd come trotting by and chase them away, and it just drove me nuts. And, of course, the theory of using him as a guinea pig didn't work out at all, because, you know, it's sort of like we were the only ones there, so we got pretty close to each other. And one day I was thinking about this and I had to laugh. I thought, you know, using him to test for toxic shellfish would almost be like coming home from work and not feeling like cooking and finding some old leftovers in the fridge that don't smell quite right and calling your kid over, your little brother over to test them for you, you know. So I was fishing a fair amount whenever the wind had let me, and he got to eat all the fish heads and the backbones, and we both ate a lot of rice and beans. My staples were rice and beans and oatmeal.
Mm-hmm.
Any dried, you know, dried food. I took a block of cheese and some bacon, but very little canned goods.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly dried stuff. So I kept my diet simple. I grew some, I sprouted lentils on a regular basis for some greenery.
Yeah, good idea.
Yeah, of course I had vitamins and like that. And
yeah.
I planted a garden, or my intention was to plant a garden, but I started some lettuce seeds in a seed flat first, and they just didn't go anywhere at all. I'm not sure. So the soil was missing something. I peed in it and put kelp in it, and nothing worked.
The wind could be a problem.
No, I had them in a protected spot, and I put them in the sun, and I bring them in at night where it's a little warmer, and it just didn't go anywhere. After 3 months, the largest lettuce leaf was the size of my fingernail. Nothing happened. But, you know, I'm good with rice and beans. I've been eating rice. I've lived in the Caribbean a lot, and I love rice and beans. I can eat them every day, twice a day. I can just live on rice and beans or something about them that are good for me. So, and I feel healthy. That's when I simplify my diet that way, I feel really much healthier than when I'm eating a whole variety of stuff. And I miss fruit and vegetables like that, but I kind of settle into that.
Mm-hmm.
That routine without a lot of difficulty.
Okay.
Missed ice cream. You know, ice cream's important. Ice cream and hot water were the things I missed most, I think.
So how would you wash? Did you bathe or in shower? I guess you would bathe in the water.
I did a sponge bath once a week.
Yeah.
Shaved. The first 6 weeks or 2 months, I didn't bathe at all. I didn't shave, didn't bathe. Mm-hmm. Don't think I washed clothes for couple of months. I was living in the same two pairs of pants and long underwear and shirts. It was pretty grungy.
Mm-hmm.
But once a week after that, I would shave and bathe down. And then not very many times, I took some hair clippers with me, electric hair clippers, but they didn't work well. And they'd kind of felt like they'd cut halfway through each hair and then yank on it till it broke. It was a pretty painful process.
Wow.
So I only did that, I think, 3 times during the year. I looked pretty rough. I lost a lot of weight. I guess I lost between 30 and 40 pounds while I was there, which was good. I was overweight when I went. And I washed clothes out on the front porch. I had a wash tub, and I'd heat water in. I'd soak them overnight, you know, to loosen the dirt, and heat water in on the stove just enough to take the real cold chill off it so it wasn't so hard on the hands.
Mm-hmm.
It was always a big job.
Mm-hmm.
And then hanging them out to dry was, you know, it was raining all the time, and so I'd put them out and bring them in and put them out and bring them in.
Oh, yeah.
And then, but when I built the cabin, I built it with a long reach, a horizontal reach of the stovepipe, specifically so that I had a long area behind which to hang clothes, because if you have a stovepipe just going up, it doesn't really leave you any place to hang clothes close to a heat source, and I really wanted to do that. Plus, it's much more efficient if you can get the smoke running horizontally inside the cabin. That whole length is producing heat instead of blowing it outside and wasting it. So I was getting all the wood I burned in with the inflatable boat, and so I was trying to be very ecologically conscious. Both the more I used, the further afield I had to go. It's not like BC down there in terms of the amount of wood. Here, if you go to a beach, you know, there's wood everywhere where you can burn it forever and ever and ever. But down there, it wasn't like that. There were a few beaches where I'd find driftwood logs, but I often had to go 3 or 4 miles away in the boat to find wood to come back and burn. So it was a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very conscious of that. And I was also trying to leave as light a footprint as I could on the land.
Was this a rowboat?
No, I had an inflatable boat, like a Zodiac. It wasn't a Zodiac, but like that, plus a 15-horsepower outboard, outboard. And then I'd go fishing whenever the wind had let me out. I'd catch fish.
So trailing off there was Bob Cole. The interview just gets better and better. I really, really enjoyed this conversation I had. And next week's episode, the whole episode will basically be the second half of the interview, where he goes into the bigger themes behind all of the actions he took. What's interesting about this segment is the actual, you know, process of getting it all together and what worked, what didn't, all of the neat little stories in between, like the cat and the hammer and the nails and the swearing and all that sort of stuff. He's a very, very great, entertaining fellow I found, and I guarantee you it just gets better and better. So I encourage you, if you're enjoying this, to tune in next week and you'll get more great story from this man who took a very, very courageous adventure, a sustainable adventure, on an island off the coast of Chile on the Pacific Ocean. But now we're going to change gears, and next up is Conrad Schmidt. I did an interview quite a while ago with Conrad Schmidt of the Work Less Party, and he'll be talking about Jevons Paradox. And again, this is what's similar here is the sort of minimalistic kind of attitude that is promoted here. And I always enjoy talking with Conrad. He's a very bright and interesting person that I know him also on a friendship level. And he's always got some kind of staggering thing that just sets my mind reeling. I found him to be a very, very deep, wise person. So here is an interview with Conrad Schmidt of the Work Less Party. You're listening to Sustainable Futures. I'm with Conrad Schmidt of the Work Less Party, who's put out a new documentary called Workers of the World Relax. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Right.
Why did workers need to relax?
The first part that it's always key to get across is that it's impossible really to reduce the work week. It's just not possible. And the reason is work is something that's always happening. Like if you're out playing soccer with your kids, you're still working. You're working to raise future healthier generations. If you're taking some time to read a book, you're still working, educating your mind and thinking. Even when you sleep, your body's still working. The problem in our society is that we become so focused on the idea of heading off to offices and factories and making consumer goods that just land up in landfills and polluting the planet and don't really make us happy and are definitely not good for the planet. What we're not doing is the other kind of work, the kind of work of music, art, family, culture, that type of work that creates a healthier society with a reduced ecological footprint. That's the basic idea I was trying to get across in the new film, Workers of the World Relax. And it's not a new idea. Like from the film, you could see a piece that I got from Kennedy, JFK, and went to Europe where I interviewed the former Minister of the Environment. And all these people are saying the same things, is that we have to slow down. We have to stop working so hard at making consumer goods that just land up in landfills and not doing the other kinds of work that actually do create a healthier, more sustainable future. Music, art, family, culture, those things that make us happy, create a stronger society, and have a reduced ecological footprint. It's nothing new.
Yeah, an interesting part of the film I found was near the beginning where there was talk about, was it JFK?
Yeah.
Said
1963.
That these great new technologies will give us more of a reduced work week, and then it didn't. In fact, didn't the work week increase?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is interesting stuff that JFK was saying. It's not new. Roosevelt and Henry Ford were saying virtually the identical thing. Not a new argument at all. 1736, there's an English gentleman. His name is James Hargreaves. Smart chap. And he comes up with an idea. Instead of spinning yarn, one spindle at a time, what if I make a machine that can spin yarn 8 spindles at a time? That invention, it was known as the spinning jenny. It was a technological revolution for its time, akin to the combustion engine and the internet for its time. It really changed things. It started the textile revolution. And the consequence of this new machine was that with half the amount of labor, you can now produce twice the amount of textiles. The consequence was the price of textiles collapsed. And the textile workers were all upset, rah, 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 and they got upset and they smashed his machines and they sent him fleeing for his life back to Nottingham. But things changed. You see, people started to consume more. Wild, radical consumerist ideas such as changing your underwear more than once a week started. Mm-hmm. And people bought more clothes. And eventually, production equaled consumption. You see, that's what technology does. Technology increases our ability to produce more goods and services. If we don't consume more, we land up in a recession. The best example is the Great Depression. The Great Depression, you have all these new inventions. You have the combustion engine. You have production lines in factories and aeroplanes. And the consequence was we were able to produce a lot more, a huge amount more stuff. But because of laissez-faire capitalism, people could not afford to buy those things. And that's why Roosevelt and Henry Ford came up with the ideas such as the Industrial Recovery Act. It was to empower the consumer so that they could match the increase in production. You see, that's the key. Technology makes things more efficient so that you can produce more, but you have to consume more. So you get caught up in the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And that cycle continues. And that's what JFK was saying. You see, there is only one way you can break out of that cycle. And what JFK was saying, there's that any increases in technological efficiency have to be offset by increase in leisure. Countless brilliant minds have talked about this issue, yet here we are in the 21st century talking about how green technology, which makes things more efficient, is going to save us. No, it doesn't. It has the exact opposite. The more efficient you make something, the more you land up producing, and you land up having to consume. If you don't, you land up in a recession. It's a very old argument that in North America, culture seems to be lost.
So what's the connection between the item is produced and then recession?
You have technology which increases efficiency.
Yeah.
So you can produce more. If you produce more, you have to consume more. Because if you don't consume more, you land up in a recession. Because production has to equal consumption.
Or it goes to waste.
Or it goes to waste.
Right.
So you land up where a situation where the price of a commodity will drop or you need less labor. What technology does, it means that you need less labor to produce the same amount of goods and services.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've been trying to do is, since we don't cut back labor, it now means that we have to consume. If we cut back labor, it means that you can balance the equation and you distribute the workload.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the idea behind a reduced work week is that, well, we know that consumerism is not a solution. So how do we reduce the size of the industrial economy without landing up in a recession? Well, the answer is that you distribute the workload to more people
mm-hmm.
so that everybody has income and can afford to live. And it also gives people more time for music, art, family, and culture. Now, these are the things that empower a population.
Mm-hmm.
And more time to get involved in politics, more time to think. Here's something interesting, because I'm busy working on a new book and a second edition to Workers Over the World Relax. There was a paper that came out, and what it showed was that countries that worked the longest hours had the biggest gap between the rich and the poor. Countries that had the short hours of work had a shorter gap between the rich and the poor.
Right. That makes sense.
Why?
Because there's more people earning incomes and it's a balanced workforce, basically.
Well, what happens is that when you reduce the work week, there's one exception, Finland, but everything else is virtually perfect. What happens is When you reduce the work week and you distribute that workload, and people have more time to get involved in politics, more time to find out what their politicians are doing, more time to learn about corruption, more time to challenge their governments, what you have is an empowered population. Mm-hmm. And the more empowered a population are, the less likely they're willing to accept social and environmental injustices and challenge a bigger gap and divide between the rich and the poor. So it is interesting, which does explain why there is this strong movement not to want to reduce the work week, at least in North America. Remember, Europe already has, in many countries, a reduced work week.
I can conceive of another effect that a reduced work week and a more shared workload could have would be increased capacity for communication, because if there's more people working, then more people sharing the same work. So you have to be able to get along with people. You have to be able to communicate what you're doing, which also I think would have a positive social impact.
When people have more time, what we see is that people get to find out who their neighbors are, more time with their kids, more time to make those interpersonal relationships. And that term in economics is called social capital. That's what you create. You create social capital instead of financial capital. Mm-hmm. And social capital is a very, very powerful thing in that it empowers people. It creates a healthier society. Like when you look at countries with really long hours of work, like the United States has the highest hours of work, you have higher incarceration rates, higher crime rates. And then you look at other countries that have lower hours of work, but yet they can afford things like public education, public health. They have lower crime rates. They have lower... there are countless benefits to the wealth of social capital. And what I mean by social capital is the communication between people, the trust between people, knowing who the neighbors are, knowing who your children are. Mm-hmm. The idea in our society that we become so focused exclusively on the work of heading off to our factories and making consumer goods that are bad for the planet and bad for us and don't really make us happy is insane, because we're not doing the work that makes people happy. There was a recent survey done by the United Nations on subjective well-being, which is how people perceive their own happiness. And countries like the United States, with the longest hours of work, and Canada, do not score all that high. Countries with lower hours of work, like Denmark and Sweden, score much higher in terms of happiness and their own happiness. So we're creating, basically in North America, a miserable group of people in a $24 billion antidepressant industry and a weaker society, whereas countries that are focusing on social capital and less consumption and more communication and knowing and time for family, art, learning, education, are creating happier societies with a reduced ecological footprint. So that's the idea that I was getting across in the film Workers of the World Relax.
So for people that are listening and that are interested in seeing the film, where can they go to?
It's as simple as clicking on www.workersoftheworldrelax.org. It's free.
How long have you been working on this?
A long, long time. This film was more work than any of my other feature-length productions, and this one was only a 20-minute production. But setting up interviews with all these famous people across the world and then having to commute huge distances just to interview, because I wanted to get experts, names that people respected who are talking about these issues. So, yeah, I got great interviews across the world.
You also have a highly regarded book, Workers of the World Relax.
Mm-hmm. And yes, the film is based on just one of the chapters.
Right. The Jevons Paradox?
Yes, the Jevons Paradox.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping to be able to turn more of the chapters in the book into films.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. What about people now that are listening and are saying, yeah, I'm working too much. I want to end the sense of labor and production. And I want to find a way to reduce my work week and also to promote this sort of thing. What kind of advice would you have for them?
Well, I can give a personal example of how it changed my life. Like, I used to be a programmer, and all the software I was writing was part of running factory plants across the world. And I had to ask myself a question. Who was I? Was I A, a productive member of society, or B, was I a landfill filler? And the answer that came back to me was that I was an environmental hazard. So I figured the first thing I needed to do was start off by getting rid of my car. And so I got rid of my car, and I started to take public transport, ride my bike, jog to work. And by doing that, I realized my standard of living was increasing because I was getting exercises I needed. When I was reading on the train, I was getting exercise my brain needed. So I then realized that because I didn't have a car, I now had about 20, maybe 25% more income. And I said, well, okay, so now what do I do? If I took that 25% of my income and I spent it on a house or computer stuff or something, I'd again be increasing my ecological footprint because each one of those things has a big impact. It's part of the consumerist cycle. If I took my 25% and flown to Europe or something for a vacation, it would have even been bigger. So what I did was I took that 25% and I said, okay, I want to reduce my work week by, well, 20%. Let's start with 20%. So it was easy. I just walked into my boss's office and I said, so boss, how many people do you think here are actually productive on a Friday? He scratched his head and said, 2 out of 100. I said, well, I'm not one of those two. How about I don't show up on a Friday and you don't pay me? He scratched his head once. Yeah, that sounds good. That's how short and easy it was for me. Mm-hmm. And my standard of living greatly improved because I now had more time to do stuff, more time to write the book, more time to make films, more time to get involved in community, making friends. And there's no ways in a million years I'll ever go back to 9 to 5 and weekends when the boss needs it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a life. It's definitely not a life.
Well, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today, Conrad.
Well, thank you.
So this has been Conrad Schmidt of the Work Less Party and producer of Workers of the World Relax, a documentary. I'm Ryan Fletcher. This is Sustainable Futures. Well, therein lies today's episode of Sustainable Futures. I hope you enjoyed these wonderful interviews, at least in my humble opinion, being the one doing the interviews. I maybe should take more of a humble approach, but it's the people I interview that makes it great. And next week, do tune in again for the rest of that Bob Cole interview. He talks at length about the process of coming back home after the island, which I thought to be a very, very interesting thing because in a year's time, all alone on a place so intimately entwined with nature, that really changes your psyche. And it was really interesting to hear him talk about what happened after he returned back. And plus, there's a lot more about his time on the island and more of the spiritual aspect of the journey. So that'll be next week. But until then, I hope that you have at least felt a little bit inspired by what's been on the program today, and you have yourself a great week. And I am Ryan Fletcher, and I'm wishing you a sustainable future.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.